Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the violence continues in Iraq. The U.S. weighs a shift in Syrian opposition aid. Syria is blamed for a spike in the number of internally displaced peoples.
The acceleration is very much due to the fluidity of the conflict and the fact that there's a lack of clear front lines.
A global Muslim survey finds support for Sharia, but also religious pluralism. It's all ahead. Bombings in central Iraq today killed at least 11 people, including anti-Al-Qaeda Sunni fighters near the former insurgent stronghold of Fallujah. The pro-government militiamen had gathered outside a military post in the city west of Baghdad to collect their pay when a suicide bomber wearing an explosive vest detonated himself near the group, killing at least three of the fighters and a civilian. Police said the blast also wounded 15 people. In a separate attack in Baghdad, a car bomb in the eastern suburb of Al-Husseiniyah killed four civilians and wounded 10 more. Another car bomb north of the city of Ramada, which, like Fallujah, is in Iraq's restive Anbar province, killed at least two policemen and wounded another 10. Today's attacks follow a wave of violence that killed scores of Iraqis in April, raising fears of a return to the sectarian violence that left tens of thousands of people dead in 2006 and 2007. We asked Wayne White, a scholar with the Middle East Institute, what is behind the current unrest.
First, we have to start by saying that there has been a continuous stream of these bombings emanating largely from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but clearly with the support of some extreme elements within the Sunni Arab community, and it is generally in reaction to Prime Minister Maliki's exclusion of the Sunni Arab community from the political mainstream in Iraq, and harassment of Sunni Arabs, even including arrests and killings. So there is a generalized provocation, but there also are new developments. And one of them is the success of the al-Nusra front in Syria, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate and which really is an arm of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so some of the expertise in Syria might be coming back. And then finally, very recently, Iraqi army and police attacked a Sunni Arab encampment, protest encampment, outside the disputed city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq. And there were a lot of casualties. And that's another more immediate provocation.
So where is this all going to lead? Where does democracy stand in Iraq?
Democracy in Iraq is in very bad shape because Maliki and company essentially have continued to consolidate power in a way that leads more to a quasi-dictatorship than a democracy of the Shia majority. Increasingly, the Sunni Arabs are being marginalized, and now, for a couple of years now, the Kurds likewise are being marginalized and are facing off with the central government. And so democracy is slipping away in Iraq.
Does that mean that the West is going to be drawn back into the country?
I doubt that because it was such a jarring experience and a costly and bloody one when the West, the United States and its coalition of the willing, was involved in Iraq. And so most powers are going to try to avoid any involvement in Iraq because of the fear of it being very costly to them.
Then what's to be done?
Iraq is probably going to continue doing what it has been doing since the United States withdrew its forces to bases in 2008 and then eventually withdrew, and that is sorting out its own problems. But increasingly that has taken the shape of a dominant Shia majority with the backing of Iran dominating the politics of the country. Eventually what might happen is the Kurds may simply go their own way. They have the wherewithal in their own contained community with their own armed forces to possibly take matters into their own hands. But for now, I think they're going to remain an autonomous part of Iraq because Turkey does not want any separation.
Wayne White, scholar with the Middle East Institute and former deputy director of the U.S. State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office. U.S. President Barack Obama reportedly is considering supplying weapons to the Syrian opposition, a move the United States has resisted because of fears the arms could end up in the hands of al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militants fighting alongside rebel forces. Senior White House officials say the president has not yet made a decision, but has asked his national security team to identify ways the United States can increase its assistance. So far, that aid has been limited to non-lethal support. Political analysts say that President Obama is reluctant to intervene in Syria, where the government and rebels accuse each other of using chemical weapons to gain the upper hand. Zlatika Hoke has this report for VOA Television.
President Obama said Tuesday he wants more facts about chemical weapons use in Syria before ordering any U.S. response.
We don't know how they were used, when they were used, who used them. We don't have a chain of custody that establishes what exactly happened. And when I am making decisions about America's national security and the potential for taking additional action in response to chemical weapon use, I've got to make sure I've got the facts.
Analysts say Mr. Obama is not ready to get involved in Syria's conflict, which has taken about 70,000 lives so far. Edward Joseph, a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, says the president is careful not to repeat the mistake of the Bush administration, which started a war in Iraq on the assumption that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
On the other hand, President Obama has created a credibility problem for himself because he has stated that the use of chemical weapons would be a red line or a game changer, so which would, of course, put his credibility and credibility of the United States at risk if, in fact, Assad has used chemical weapons and then the U.S. does not react.
Joseph says the administration also wants to avoid getting mired in a situation that may not be easily solved. Middle East analyst Marina Ottaway of the Woodrow Wilson Center says the Obama administration is getting closer to the point when it will have to act, but it has not yet decided how.
I am sure that it will not be by putting boots on the ground. I don't even think that it's going by offering air cover, by cooperating in establishing a no-fly zone. I think it's much more likely for, at least as a first step, to take the form of sending arms to the rebels, to the Syrian rebels. But it's a decision that the United States is not willing to make yet.
The Assad government has been accused of using weapons loaded with nerve agents against targets in civilian areas. It has, in turn, accused the rebels of using chemical weapons in a village near Aleppo. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Syria's United Nations ambassador blames what he calls some influential countries for the delay in sending a chemical weapons investigation team to his nation. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
On March 20th, the Syrian government asked UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to set up an independent and impartial investigation to probe its concerns that chemical weapons were used by armed groups in the town of Khan Asal in Aleppo province that week. Mr. Ban acted quickly, announcing the next day that he would send a team to investigate. But more than a month later, the 15-person technical mission awaits permission from the Syrian government to enter the country. At issue is the scope of the investigation. Syria wants only Khan Asal investigated, but Britain and France have raised another possible incident of chemical weapons use in Homs. The UN chief has said the team should investigate all credible allegations and has urged the Syrian authorities to give the mission full and unfettered access to do their work. Syrian Ambassador Bashar Jafari told reporters Tuesday that his government is cooperating with the UN and is still waiting to receive the team, but wants to see the Khan Asal incident investigated before it is willing to begin considering the investigation of other allegations.
But we said that let us now fulfill, achieve in a credible manner, impartial, independent manner, the investigation in Khan al-Asal. Then, if the Syrian government and the Secretary General and the Security Council members feel that these allegations are also credible, the Syrian government might examine the possibility of asking for further investigation.
The Syrian envoy accused hostile governments of seizing on the chemical weapons issue to increase political pressure on President Bashar al-Assad. He sidestepped the question of whether the Syrian authorities possess chemical weapons, repeating the government line that if they do, they would not use them on their own people. Speaking to reporters Monday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon again called for full access to locations in Syria, saying it is necessary if the United Nations is to be able to establish the facts and clear up doubts surrounding this issue.
A credible and comprehensive inquiry requires full access to the site where chemical weapons are alleged to have been used. I again urge Syrian authorities to allow the investigation to proceed without delay and without any conditions.
Mr. Bond's spokesman said Tuesday that the Syrian government's efforts to expedite the deployment of the mission to investigate Khan Asil are welcome, but that cooperation should be extended to other sites. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're tuned to the Voice of America, broadcasting to you from Washington. We invite you to stop by our two websites, voanews.com and MiddleEastVoices.com, for world news. The conflict in Syria is being blamed for a spike in the number of internally displaced peoples, or IDPs, in the world. Claire Spurrell of the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says there are new reasons for people being displaced in 2012.
In 2011, it was very much the Arab Spring uprising and the post-election violence in Côte d'Ivoire, which caused a lot of the new displacement that year. This last year, we've seen the new displacement caused by the escalating violence in eastern DRC and, of course, the ongoing conflict in Syria, which caused really the majority of new displacement.
Spurrell describes Syria as the fastest evolving internal displacement crisis in the world.
The acceleration is very much due to the fluidity of the conflict and the fact that there's a very much a lack of clear front lines and the subsequent close relationship between internal displacement and the conflict hotspots.
Since IDPs have not crossed borders of neighboring countries, they're not considered refugees and as a result may receive little or no assistance. The International Medical Aid Group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, has been working to provide treatment over the past 10 days to more than 1,700 migrants in Yemen. Among them are women and children who have been recent victims of human trafficking. The group reports that most of the victims were tortured by smugglers, and many went without food for up to a week while in captivity. MSF says the medical, humanitarian, and psychological needs of migrants are extensive. Officials with Doctors Without Borders say they are extremely worried about the future of the thousands of migrants stranded in Yemen. Most of them are Ethiopian. Tarek Daher is head of mission for MSF and is in Sana'a, Yemen. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the plight of the migrants as they attempt to cross the border looking for a better life.
According to the information that we have, around 105,000 migrants are coming on a yearly basis from the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia mainly, up to Yemen, trying to go or to cross the Saudi borders in order to find some work there. And what happened about 10 days ago, the Yemeni authorities did a raid against smugglers who are keeping about 1,700 migrants in order to either money from them or to push them to work in their farm for free. Those people, when they were freed by the authorities, they were kept in two main centers, one in Harat, which is in the north part of Yemen, close to the Saudi borders. And part of them were transferred from this area close to the capital, to Sana'a. What we did is we went and tried to give some medical treatment for those who are in need. And this is where we saw that, in fact, they were tortured by the smugglers here in Yemen.
What type of condition, then, did you find these victims?
They were either beaten, they pulled up the nails, or wounded, or they were also beaten in order that if they have money to give it to the smuggler, or what they were also doing is the smuggler were giving them phone in order that they phone to the country and that their family sends the money before being released by the smuggler. And they have also the psychological disorder was quite high among all those migrants after being released by the authorities.
How many of the migrants would you say were actually tortured?
Most of them. We don't have really figures. What we did is we did the screening when they were liberated, and about 70 to 100 of those migrants were badly injured. MSF took them to the hospital where we are working and tried to treat them medically. And you have also some of them who were mentally, they have some, many problems in that, and MSF tried to give them some mental health session in order to just help them to understand a little bit what is going on for them.
Those that are suffering mentally and psychologically, are they truly understanding what they actually experience?
Yes, I think so. In fact, we are doing as much as we can, and the authorities are providing to those migrants since a couple of days, about a week. They are just with the agreement most of the time with the migrants. They are sending them back home. And at least what we are doing here is to do mental sessions in order just to help them just to understand that now they are free. Yesterday they did like 150 were sent back home, and they are speaking about two other round of 100 or 120 to be sent also in a couple of days.
I understand that some of them had not eaten for up to 7 days. Are you treating them, and what is their condition?
Some of the migrants who were liberated by the Yemeni authorities seems not to have any kind of food for about 7 days. What the authorities, when they were liberating them, they gave them food, and just MSF added on top of it also some food. They were in a bad condition for sure after 7 days, especially that those people were, as we said, mentally affected, and they were also mistreated by those smugglers.
I understand that some of these migrants were also women and children. What kind of state of mind are they in at this point?
Out of 1,700 people, something like 160 women and maybe 60 children were among those migrants. Again, the condition of those people were quite bad.
I know that you all have mentioned before that you're very worried about the future of the thousands of migrants who are still stranded there in Yemen. How will you be able to assist them?
We are urging, first, the international community to help. Quite a lot of migrants, thousands of migrants, are trying to pass through Yemen, and they have not much assistance in the country as they are trying to pass by and to cross the border to Saudi Arabia. Our concern is that first, those people should be helped, and second, just to emphasize that those people have to be in a way or another protected against those smugglers who are most of the time keeping them, torturing them in order to get either money before they release them. And this is a concern that everybody, including the international community, should understand that those migrants have quite a lot of problem while passing from Yemen to the border of Saudi Arabia.
Tarek Daher, head of mission for Doctors Without Borders. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Sana'a, Yemen. Egyptian activists are concerned that the rise of Islamist politicians could undermine years of work to discourage female genital mutilation. But as Elizabeth Arrett reports from Cairo, the practice and the movement against it have far deeper roots in the country.
To its supporters, it's a sign of purity, community, and religious devotion. To its opponents, it marks the physical manifestation of a woman's degradation. Female genital mutilation, FGM, is an ancient custom here in Egypt, with references predating both Islam and Christianity. The practice remains widespread, with estimates today suggesting as many as 90% of Egyptian women are affected. Egypt criminalized all forms of FGM in 2008, and rights monitors say the number of girls undergoing the operation has dropped by about one-third. But Nahad Abu Komsam, director of the Egyptian Center for Women's Rights, says the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood and more conservative Salafist politicians threatens those gains.
They come to say, we may have a law to make it in a certain condition, or it is good to protection. They destroying years of effort to protecting girls and women in Egypt.
Courts have rejected legal challenges to the current ban, but with the judiciary and the government of President Mohamed Morsi at odds, worries are growing. Adding to concerns are predictions that Salafists are poised to do well in parliamentary elections later this year. Komsan says non-governmental work on the ground and respect for motivations are key to changing attitudes about FGM. She divides people who support FGM into three groups: those who see it as a social and cultural ceremony, those who believe it will help women control their sexuality, and those who believe it's mandated by religion. She says offering alternatives is easiest in the first two groups, by substituting different non-invasive rituals that celebrate either womanhood or community. The spirit of the occasion is preserved without the damage to a woman or girl's body. Political activist and filmmaker Hala Galal describes the efforts of one village that chose to reject FGM.
Even the lady who was supposed to making this operation herself by her hand, she also swore, and she also stopped. And now she's doing something like weddings, and she changed her career also.
As for those who think FGM will keep women from expressing their sexuality, Komsan argues that training the mind is a far more effective and humane approach.
They have to understand that protection is not by cutting part of our body, but by educating ourselves how to control our life and by sending our girls to school.
It's the third part, says Komsan, that's the hardest.
I always joke and say FGM is a sign of unify between Muslims and Christians in Egypt, because both of them insist it's a part of their religious.
It is not, and even though both the head of the prestigious Al-Azhar Institute and Christian leaders have spoken out against the practice, the link to religion remains. Political activist Galal says there's yet another issue anti-FGM advocates face: the charge they're trying to impose Western values on Egypt.
And I always tell people who accuse us of serving the Western agenda, I said to him, what is the other agenda, to oppress women?
It's an uphill battle for anti-FGM activists, but one marked by both legal and grassroots successes so far. Their worry now is that in the current political climate, the road ahead may be even steeper. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
A majority of Muslims around the world believe Sharia, or traditional Islamic law, should prevail in the countries in which they live. But at the same time, most say they favor religious freedom for people of other faiths, according to a new survey. VOA's Jerome Sokolovsky reports.
The survey by the Pew Research Center is based on more than 38,000 face-to-face interviews in countries where Muslims are both a majority and a minority. Its focus was on Muslim views on religion and politics. One of the key findings was that 6 in 10 Muslims in the Middle East and nearly 8 in 10 in sub-Saharan Africa believe their national laws should be based on the Islamic code of Sharia. In Afghanistan, the figure was 99%. Pew researcher Jim Bell acknowledged the difficulties of conducting the survey in countries where such topics may be sensitive or have what he called socially desirable answers.
It's possible to read into some of the findings that this is obviously a very popular answer to say that Sharia should be made the official law of the country.
But he said specific follow-up questions suggested the understanding of Sharia varies from place to place and is often seen as useful in property and family disputes.
As we look across regions and countries, there's often less support in many countries for applying Sharia in the form of criminal punishments or enforcing the death penalty for Muslims who renounce their faith and convert to another religion.
Bell also said that despite support for Sharia, most Muslims think it does not apply to non-Muslims. He said that in spite of restrictions on non-Muslim communities in a number of countries, many say they favor religious freedom for people of other faiths. The researchers compared the findings with earlier surveys and found that American Muslims are much more likely to have close friends of other faiths, and more than half say other religions can lead to eternal life in heaven. That's compared to 96% of Egyptian Muslims and 92% of Pakistani Muslims, and overwhelming majorities in other countries who say Islam is the only true religion. Jerome Sokolovsky, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.